In this episode of Dear Analyst, I'm very privileged and excited to have Amanda McCulloch. She is a data visualization designer based in Washington, D.C. Talk all about, as you guessed, data visualization, data storytelling, and everything in between. Amanda, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to dive into our interesting conversation.
And I know you have a quite interesting background. I'd love for you to just kind of talk to the audience about who you are, what you've done in your kind of professional experience leading up to where you are today.
Sure. I think like every good data visualization practitioner who does this kind of work full time these days, I didn't start in this field. I took a very meandering career path, which I think each stage or phase of it has made a lot of logical sense to get me where I am today. But if you actually looked at my undergraduate and graduate degrees, I have an undergraduate degree in zoology and sociology. And I have a master's degree in public health. And so if you look at the combination of my academic credentials, I don't think you would have guessed that I would have forayed a career in data visualization design.
Definitely not.
So I started off my career after my MPH, which I did immediately after undergrad, exiting school in the world of 2008. And when I went ahead and I kicked off my career, I had the luxury of working on this really interesting collaborative team, small collaborative team, supporting USAID with making web content and reports to Congress and different analytical reports. And I was on the analytics team doing the analysis work. So looking at big open data sets from the World Bank and WHO and from USAID and through the demographic and health surveys, and helping to summarize that data in narrative and in some charts and graphs. But we were part of this team that had graphic designers and web developers on it. And so I got to see what graphic designers would do with my charts and graphs, which were pretty horrendous looking at the time, and actually take them and level them up to tell clearer stories and communicate more effectively, which is really what piqued my interest in the world of data visualization design. And over the course of over a decade, I went from being an analyst who occasionally made charts and graphs to actually growing my own skill sets through a lot of self-teaching, reading, listening to podcasts like this, and going on to lead and build a data visualization team within one of the public health firms where I worked, and later spend 5 years working in the private sector, seeing if I could pick up tips and tricks from what I assumed would be all the magical solutions private sector organizations had around data and analytics, and bring them back into the world of global health, which is where I am today. And what I think was funny is I went and worked in these other kind of private sector client environments for really large companies. And what it seemed like was they were facing a lot of the same challenges that we had in global health. They just sometimes had more money to throw at the problem, and sometimes they wanted the solutions done faster. And so it was a really interesting time to be able to look at the ways in which big enterprise scale type projects were done and delivered. Whereas when I was working in public health, I was working a lot more with community health organizations and smaller scale dashboards that might be refreshed on, say, a monthly basis. Whereas we were looking at dashboards that were being refreshed daily in some of the client environments I was in. So I've taken this meandering path that I think has let me go ahead and take advantage of some of the research and data skills that I learned from my undergrad and graduate degrees. But really, at the end of the day, thinking about and centering who is it I'm communicating with and taking a very data humanist perspective to how I think about data visualization as this opportunity to engage people with data and information in a fun and exciting way. I like to describe to my toddler that what mommy does for work is I make pictures with numbers. And he thinks that's really cool. And I love that he thinks that's really cool.
That's probably the best way to describe what a data visualization expert does too.
In a sentence, right? How do you describe our job in one single sentence?
Just to get into the nitty gritty a little bit, when you mentioned that you're working with these open data sets, when you're building these reports mm-hmm. for USAID, I'm guessing, were you building your charts like in Excel and then the graphic designers were using Illustrator or something else to make them more pretty, quote unquote?
Yeah, that's exactly what the workflow often looked like. You'd build something in Excel or using Stata or SPSS. And then take that output, and they would take that kind of structural underpinning of the precise encodings of where the different things were plotted on the chart, And then they would go ahead and do a lot of the decluttering and focusing with color and adding meaningful text that I often think about and do now on every single chart I create that has this kind of goal around communicating information and more of the data storytelling of presenting a specific analytical finding.
Got it. And then I'd be remiss to not ask you about how you came to start working with the Data Visualization Society, where you are the executive director. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, sure. It's interesting because I often have people say to us when we talk about Data Viz Society, oh, like how big is the team of people, the staff that runs DVS? And the answer is it's run by a volunteer board. So my volunteer is the executive director for DVS. I love that part of what I do because it keeps me connected to the broader community around data visualization design writ large. And the roots of the Data Viz Society started at Tapestry Conference in 2018. So I think November of 2018 down in Miami, Florida. Alberto Cairo was hosting down at the University of Miami. And Elijah Meeks, one of the co-founders, gave a talk about the third wave of data visualization. This idea that a lot of our BI type tools like Tableau were being used in more custom and artistic ways, but also a lot of the notebook type platforms that he was used to working in were being used in a lot more BI type ways, building reports and automating reports. And we see that more and more today, right, in the world of Jupyter Notebooks and other tools. And a big conversation that I think wasn't new to that environment, but was really sparked there was, where's the space for the people who are the Tableau people and the Power BI people and the data artists and the data journalists to all get together and connect with each other and share not just kind of knowledge and best practices, but also inspiration and build more community. And so DVS was really kind of birthed out of that space in November of 2018, went live in February of 2019. And I was leadership team member number 4, working with our 3 founders, Elijah, Amy, and Molly, to get the organization stood up and started as the operations director, trying to help us build a nonprofit association that could outlive any one group of board members. Always a challenge for nonprofits and for community organizations, right? And then also eventually transitioning into the role of the executive director, where we've really honed in on our 3 core goals around celebrating the field of data visualization, nurturing this cross-functional tool agnostic data visualization community, and finding ways to advance the practice of data visualization. And that includes helping people think about themselves as data visualization creators, even if that's not their job title. We often talk about the ways in which engaging with data and information is kind of like being able to read these days, to engage with the world in different ways. We see charts and graphs in so many different spaces. And as a public health professional, I focused a lot on that during COVID and seeing the ways in which we were communicating pandemic information through charts and graphs and visualizations. And as we think about what it means to advance that field, I think it's thinking about the ways in which everyone learning to build charts and build them so that they communicate a little bit more effectively, or build dashboards that are a little bit more UX optimized and bring in a bit more of those UX and graphic design principles, benefits everyone because it enables more people to engage with data and information in an exciting and meaningful way. And so as DVS, we try to bring people together and have built a community of over 31,000 people around the world across over 160 different countries. And have a lot coming down the pike this year, including our Outlier Conference in June, which is always a fun space for bringing everyone together. And this year, we'll be gathering in Chicago, which, as an Illinois native, brings me a bit of extra added joy.
Well, that's awesome. We'll definitely include links to DVS and the conference as well for those who are interested. And speaking of DVS, I know that DVS has an online journal blog publication, if you will, called Nightingale. And you wrote a post for the journal a few months ago called "Has Data Storytelling Reached Its Peak?" which we'll probably focus on most of this conversation. But wanted to start off high level. Can you give us your definition, or what you think the definition should be for a data story? I talk about data storytelling a lot on the podcast with different guests, and I feel like I kind of know what it is, but we'd love to hear your definition of what a data story is.
Data stories and data storytelling is such an interesting phrase to me because it means so many different things to different people. And I think having shared language matters a lot, right? It matters in how we communicate with each other as analysts and data visualization creators. So we have a shared understanding of what we're making. And it matters when we're talking to clients who maybe we're talking about what they're looking for, or trying to have us build. And they say, I need these great data stories. I need dashboards that tell data stories. When what they really need actually is a pretty simple monitoring report that lets them figure out where they should dive in deeper and start to craft those stories from. So as I think about data storytelling, one of my favorite definitions and kind of frameworks for thinking about what a data story is comes from a set of conversations from 2014 amongst a group of different data viz practitioners, where Robert Corsara, who formerly was at Tableau Research and now is at Observable, wrote that a data story does three key things. It ties facts together. So there's a reason why there's a collection of facts that are in a story, and the story gives you that reason. It provides a narrative path through those facts. So it's not just putting them out there in front of you. It's drawing connections and creating kind of the shape of a story or narrative arc, which can look a lot of different ways. But it guides the reader or viewer through that world. And then it presents a particular interpretation of those facts. So there's one specific path or storyline that you're pulling through those various disconnected pieces of information. And what I really love about that is the third part, and recognizing that data storytelling requires that we think about what's the analytical insight we want someone to take away from a chart or graph, such that if I hide the chart and read just the headline at the top, I can actually grab what the key takeaway was. So regardless of my levels of data literacy or graphicacy or something else, I could see what that kind of key headline was and know what someone was trying to communicate rather than leaving that to chance. It reduces the cognitive load for my reader, and it presents a kind of key specific finding. And really great data storytelling, I think, oftentimes takes that step beyond those short stories. I think of headlines on charts and graphs, kind of like short stories that we tell one specific key finding. And these larger narrative arcs being these things that move through and move across various data points, triangulating maybe qualitative and quantitative information together, taking a certain shape, whether it's that dramatic arc or a Pixar story spine or one of the many kind of, Kurt Vonnegut has an amazing short talk all about the shape of stories. And I love thinking about it in the context of data, but that's perhaps too far adjacent to our topic of conversation today of diving into Vonnegut's shapes of stories. But I think that Josh Smith, who wrote another great article in Nightingale, talks about the fact that storytelling as a phrase is often used as this blanket statement to describe how well information is presented in an interpretable presentation with a logical flow. And the challenge there is that really great storytelling, which he knows a lot about because his roots in his undergrad are in folklore, really includes also this idea of a narrator or cast of characters or meaningful and memorable people that create this sense of empathy between us and what we're hearing. And so as we think about crafting these broader stories and data storytelling, where we pull these pieces together, I think that human element, thinking about who the characters are, who the people are represented in or impacted by the data, is a really crucial element of what makes a really great data story and not just a well-presented sequence of pieces of information on a set of slides.
That's a really, really good definition. And I think
there's
many...
really long definition.
A really long definition.
Everything a definition shouldn't be in Webster's, I think.
Well, I mean, it's good to hear your perspective, who like someone who's like very involved with data visualization versus other folks who kind of mentioned it in passing. So having a long definition is, I think, a great thing to have from you. One follow-up to this is actually in the post, you did share some charts around cervical cancer screening and how they declined during the pandemic. And this question is a little bit of a zinger. I'm curious if you've, in your public health experience and elsewhere, where you've built a visualization, you're trying to tell a story, and for whatever reason, the audience doesn't walk away with the right takeaway. And the reason why I ask this is because when you brought up these charts around COVID and the pandemic, obviously, you know, there was a lot of charts appearing around that time and reporting on the different statistics. And I'm sure many of those charts were interpreted in the wrong way. I'm curious if you ever had an experience where you're working on a chart and for whatever reason, or maybe you didn't find the reason, the story you wanted to tell wasn't what the audience walked away with.
Ooh, that's a great question.
Yeah, I mentioned it was a zinger, so.
I love zingers. They're great. I think it's tricky because I think it's such a luxury when we get to hear back from our audience, right? When you get to hear from someone, like, what is it that you took away from this chart? Especially if you're putting something into, say, a report to Congress. Like, I never got a set of notes back on the quality of our charts and these annual reports to Congress from a staffer who said, you know, this really would have communicated more effectively if instead of doing X, you did Y. So I will say, I do think it's a luxury to get that back. And to any analyst listening, if you have the opportunity to get that kind of feedback on your work from your audience, not just a collaborator or colleague, that's invaluable information, right? And it's easy to be dismissive when that happens because you sometimes become so attached to the visual idea or concept or kind of structure you've created. I could think when I've been giving presentations in the past, and perhaps a different kind of way of answering this question, and then I'll maybe pull on a thread from COVID, is when I'm giving examples of a chart or graph and I say, what do you think works well on this chart and what doesn't? It's usually a chart I've created. And there's always things people find that they don't like about it, that they don't think communicate clearly, and that maybe kind of go counter to what they would think of. And so as you're thinking about the ways in which you get and give feedback, I think that making sure you're clear on the kind of feedback you're looking for, if you're gathering that kind of information, is important. And making sure that you're asking people kind of what jumps out to them and what do they see in the chart or graph that you've created. I know some folks who really dislike dumbbell charts. I love dumbbell charts. I think they're much more effective than paired column charts. But if all you've ever seen in your life is a paired column chart, you might have a certain amount of comfort with that. Mm-hmm. And so as you think about the feedback that you get, I've had times when people look at a chart or a graph and they get frustrated perhaps because it says something counter to what they believe. And when they see the numbers on a chart or graph, maybe they have more knowledge or information about the underlying data source that I had. And they're able to poke out and say, you know, I think that that number looks really low, but I think that's wrong. I think there's a data quality issue there or something else, where I actually need to listen to them and listen to them because they have the subject matter knowledge and insight to really kind of think about and understand what's happening. Mm. When we were working in the course of the pandemic, I worked on some different charts and graphs for a set of dashboards on COVID knowledge, attitudes, and practices around the world in partnership with Johns Hopkins University's Center for Communication Programs. And when we were trialing and testing different ways to present data on the survey data, one of the challenges was how do you present really dense information and still make it easy to kind of glean key insights and look quickly for information that matters to you. And I think when we were working through that project, we would actually go through the process of showing people multiple different iterations or versions of the same chart on one single, like, Google Jamboard or Miro board. Pandemic world, everything was virtual. And so we'd look at it and we'd say, what do you see? And what are the patterns that you see in terms of how this is laid out? And the stories someone would glean from different presentations of information, focusing in on a section of the chart that was all about people who were not likely to accept the COVID vaccine versus those who were. Simple choices about kind of ordering, sorting, color, all impacted what kind of story or takeaway someone had from each of those different charts. And I think that iterating and getting feedback on that was really important before anything went into production. Because in a world of charts with COVID, we saw so many examples where charts were put out in the wild, graphs, maps, all kinds of pieces of information, and plucked up and taken out and cherry-picked and complained about by different people saying they were misleading people in different ways. And one of the challenges we saw was the kind of emerging kind of top end of the scale, right, of the number of COVID deaths or number of COVID cases, that charts and graphs that were designed more for story finding and discovery and analysis on a dashboard. And so the screenshot from, I don't know, March or April of 2020 had a ceiling of 1,000 cases a day. And as that ceiling grew higher and higher and higher, all that happened was that the same color ramp on a map was expanded out to represent a larger and larger scale of information, such that when you present the same screenshot from the same dashboard 3 months later, and you say, wait, dark red means 1,000 on this one, dark red means 10,000 on this one, that's misleading. I think we have to think about the ways in which things were designed and for what purpose.
Exploration versus explanation. I know those are really big words, but I wonder if you could talk to us, and specifically for an analyst who is in charge of, like, making charts internally for the organization and their bosses, hey, I want to view these trends and have some takeaways. Can you describe what you mean by this continuum, specifically more for like an analyst who is working in a company and
sure.
in charge of building charts and dashboards and also telling stories at the same time?
That's a big job, you know, charts, dashboards, stories, all those things all wrapped up together. It's like you're a data person and a comms person all at once.
100%.
I think as you think about that continuum, and in my mind, that continuum from explanation to exploration, when I think about the goals of data exploration and building a dashboard, where I need to start from is always asking who is going to use this dashboard and when are they going to use it? And what are their key kind of needs that they have in terms of the questions they might want to answer? I have different tools in my toolbox that I've built up that borrow from the world of user-centered design that I really like when you're starting out that kind of dashboard design process and that user research, starting from a place of doing initial interviews with people across stakeholder groups and compiling some different mindset maps or personas that represent illustrative users. So I can go back to and say, kind of, is this dashboard I've designed so far serving this specific key audience or user? And I like thinking about the differences between those different users and groups. One of the challenges you often have as an analyst is being tasked with developing the dashboard that serves all people with all things, right? Or at least serves too many things to too many people. And so sometimes mapping out those personas or stakeholder groups, audiences early on, and then considering on kind of a continuum of kind of dots along a line, how much does this person really want stories versus just the numbers, or charts versus just the numbers? Are they going to go ahead and look for the table of the data no matter what? So you really should make sure it's in there. Do they have low or high levels of data literacy? Do they have deep knowledge in the technical area or topic you're presenting on? If you're presenting a P&L statement or P&L dashboard to a finance person, that's going to be a lot more easily understood than someone who doesn't have that knowledge. And going on and thinking about kind of how would you plot each of these different personas on these continuums that would allow us to see where there are similarities and differences. And then actually doing a little journey map of during the course of an illustrative week or month, whatever the kind of term is for the data refresh on the dashboard, how often are they going to actually engage with this dashboard? When do you expect them to use it? Is it replacing using some kind of automated table report or slide deck that they're often delivered? And what can we borrow from those existing artifacts that need to be repeated in the dashboard? So all to say, focusing on spending time with defining who your audience is and what their needs are and their needs and preferences and pain points allows you to build a much more customized exploratory tool for those audiences if you're building something for data exploration or story finding, where the goal is to monitor conditions and then look at and see what's happening. If you're a dashboard creator and an analyst who's tasked with that kind of role, one of the best things you can do for your audience when you're developing that kind of analytical tool is to reduce the cognitive load on your user and make sure that if something is going down, for example, and that's cause for concern, that there's some way with an alert icon or color or some other feature that allows you to draw that eye in and say, focus here. Because dashboards are often very data rich or data dense. And so how do we enable people to really focus their attention on the things that demand their attention and demand action and further exploration? Whereas if you go along that continuum over to the world of data storytelling, you're often taking one of those ideas, one of those points of celebration or concern, perhaps from a dashboard, and then pulling it out, crafting a really compelling, simplified, easy to understand visual, and perhaps unpacking and kind of taking that five whys approach and saying, well, why did we have this great success on this metric in quarter one? Well, it was because we did this, and we did that because we did this, and we did that because we did this. Till you get down to some of those root causes, that helps you build out what that data story really is. That it's not just a data point. It's a data point supported by the story of how we got there.
And that's kind of where you involve more words, like the chart title, subtitle, to really hammer home, this is the key takeaway I want you to walk away with. Is that right?
Or annotations, right? Annotation layers are so powerful. I think about like some of the best line charts you ever see in data journalism and other spaces. If you go over and want, like, really pay attention to not just what the charts are in, say, The Economist, but like, what are the features of those charts that help them communicate effectively? it's often that there's this great annotation layer that when I look at something, a line goes up, a line goes down. There's some little box or call out that anticipates my needs and tells me why it happened. And they're often working in these, in that kind of data journalism environment, in these static charts and graphs that are printed as is. But if you're going ahead and, say, delivering a set of slides for an executive stakeholder, you could take the same chart and layer it five times across five different slides in the exact same position on each slide and add an annotation on each one. And as you click through the slides, you get this animated effect that draws our attention and goes down the line and explains to us exactly what happens. I think we overcomplicate data storytelling sometimes. I think a well-annotated line chart can tell a really effective and beautiful data story.
Got it. One follow-up to the kind of data exploration side of things, and this is, I think, more of like kind of a practical question from an analyst who's working inside a company. You tell me if you've experienced this before from your experience working with other companies. I'm an analyst. I have these different stakeholders, different audiences I have to work with to understand what are their needs for this dashboard, what are their needs for this exploration. But is there a case where I learned that, marketing wants to see this chart, customer support wants to see this chart, engineering wants to see this chart, but the only tool I have in my disposal is, let's say, Tableau, but I know this audience will be better served by, a Google Sheets chart. This other audience might better serve with like a chart from Mode. This audience might be better served with a chart from Google Data Studio. But from a practical perspective, you only have one dashboarding tool. So I'm curious how you have those conversations internally where you want to serve all these different audiences, but what they want might not be served by the tools that you have like paid for as a company, for instance. Have you ever run into that before when you're doing this survey?
Yeah. Oh, okay. And I've made terrible mistakes where I once, when I was early on adapting my Tableau-centered kind of dashboard world and doing more work in Power BI, and this is before Power BI had some of its current features, I made the mistake of actually just sketching out and wireframing and prototyping paper prototype bits of dashboards based on our requirements and things for a team. And only then learning that Power BI really didn't support dot strip plots. And that was a key feature across a good chunk of the dashboard because of the level of granularity of the data that we wanted to see and focusing on the distribution. You could build them more easily now. This is years ago. And it was before the days of having more flexibility inside of Power BI. But it was I will say, if you are in the situation where you are tool limited, getting to know and understanding the constraints of the visualizations that tool can be used to create is really important, especially if you feel like you're saying, your mind can go a million other places in terms of more effective ways to serve up that same data. Now, I think when you're looking at that kind of tool constraint, some tools have more true constraints than other tools have, in the sense that some tools think through a language of charts, right? Where you kind of think in a taxonomic way. I'm going to build a bar chart and I pick the bar chart with my underlying data and then I customize the features of the bar chart, the legend, the color, the size, those kind of things, all those visual encodings. And so you're limited to the repository of charts in that tool. And in Excel, you'll see a lot of the hacks in Excel are actually built off of scatter plots, where you're actually plotting something on this XY plane, a set of dots or bars or lines. And then you're customizing all the grid lines and other features on it to give the approximation of a chart type that doesn't exist in Excel by itself. So you hack it to do what you want. You hack things in Tableau and other tools too. I'm not meaning to be rude to Excel. I really like Excel a lot. I use Excel a lot in my work still.
Yeah.
But as you think about the tool and what it can do, some tools are built in that taxonomic way where it takes a lot more labor to build that chart in a tool that doesn't have that native capability. Whereas other tools or environments like Tableau or using the ggplot libraries in R, they're built on this grammar of graphics framework where you're functionally picking, choosing, and customizing each of the individual encodings of the data visualization, the size, how big is the dot or bubble, the position, where is it on the XY plane, the Z order, which dots are in front of or behind the others, outline, transparency, color. The list of encodings could go on and on. And so I think when you are in an environment where you have a tool that thinks with that grammar of graphics thinking, that underpinning kind of way it's coded in design. You have a lot more freedom and flexibility. I think the other big mistake that we make is sometimes as analysts and dashboard developers is that the charts or graphs that might be beautiful and work wonderfully as a static image that you only have to build once and don't have to be performant and render as data is changing and filters are updated can be different than the charts and graphs that work well with an interactive tool for data exploration, where your data has to get refreshed on a regular cadence. And you can't do the data densification and pulling in extra additional tables to create underlying matrices, to force Tableau to build some kind of custom chart that would end up making your dashboard take 10 minutes to render that chart in any kind of production environment. And I think as analysts, we're often having to think about not just that kind of what works well for storytelling versus story finding from a visual perspective, but also from a performance perspective. And the things that we can hack together and do for static charts and graphs we only have to build once is going to look very different from what we do in some cases on an interactive dashboard that has to be responsive to picking and choosing filters and refreshing data and drilling into information in more depth.
That's such an important point. It reminds me of my early days as an analyst when I was building charts. And, you know, I'm typically building in Excel, very static images, but then there's always someone in the meeting who says, well, what about for this region? Or what about for the previous year? And then you're trying to export that chart into a tool that allows for, like you said, the dashboarding and exploration type of things when that chart was really meant to be just kind of a one-time use kind of thing.
It's so. The more artistic ones that really get me. Like there's a
there was one from
McKinsey that Gabrielle Marit worked on that had things about cows being large producers of methane gas, I think. But it had three-dimensional bars and a cow on it. And on the surface, that sounds terrible, right? That sounds like something about to get absolutely panned on the Data is Beautiful Reddit or some other space that critiques data visualization. But there was a lot of celebration of the fact that it was presenting climate-related data that no one was paying a lot of attention to. And it got people talking and it got them engaged. But I'm not going to start putting three-dimensional bars and a cow onto dashboards I'm building, even if it's for like a food and nutrition program, because that doesn't make logical sense in that environment. And those kind of visual illustrations and additional things that can create such engaging charts to illustrate data stories don't work well in that more analytical monitoring conditions kind of environment where they might just distract me from seeing that one of my regions had kind of bottomed out on a key metric last quarter.
Although I think it will be fun to see a dynamic chart with cows and 3D charts and stuff. That could be interesting to see.
Have you looked at any of the, this is a divergence, but on the kind of illustrated dashboard side of things, some of, I think, just the most comical dashboard renderings I've seen lately are when someone writes a Midjourney prompt or another AI kind of image prompt, but build me a dashboard about oceans with whales. And you end up with this beautiful, artistic, very Midjourney 3D rendering of a dashboard that you never build in production, right?
Right.
And you even look at some of the dashboards and things that are submitted in, say, a Tableau IronViz feeder. And those aren't going to be things that work really well as business dashboards. Those are things that work really well if you're trying to tell a clearer data story that have a sequence of events and you're using charts to unfold and explore something. But they're not meant to be updated. I won't give away names, but I talked to a Tableau visionary once who I saw one of their pieces of work. And I said, I loved this thing you did. Can you help me understand how you built it? And they said, please never look at the side of that workbook. Never look at it. It is an absolute mess.
Right.
And it's not one of my chart chat colleagues, by the way. It's some other Tableau visionary. But to defend Andy, Jeff, and Steve for a moment. As you kind of look at those kind of pieces, I think there are things like that that we do, even in Tableau, that you do just to kind of make it work. But they're not going to work if you try to publish it and refresh it on a Tableau server for an executive or for an analytics group.
Right. Yeah. Very good takeaways. Two last questions. Second to last one is, in the post, you talked about story finding is kind of the first step even before you get into storytelling, story exploration. And kind of want to turn this question back on you for a bit. Can you give an example of story finding that you're doing right now that is interesting, that's kind of you're taking a lot of time on? Because I think we're all trying to find the story from different analyses we're doing. Curious what data visualization expert like yourself, what kind of story finding exercises you're doing these days?
Sure. And I think as you think about projects, and I think one of the constraints on projects, I will quickly say, is a lot of projects we don't get the luxury of talking about. So I have some cool story finding things that I'm doing with one of my clients that are interesting and involve kind of using a dashboard as a starting place, but are not great fodder for a podcast.
Yeah. Whatever you're comfortable sharing.
I think one example I think to think about, and a very tangible one for me, is as the DVS executive director, we're approaching our fifth anniversary or 5-year birthday in February. And one of the things we've been trying to get a handle on and understand, because people ask us all the time, is things like membership numbers, more about the membership profile. What are people interested in? Like, how do we better understand who our membership is so we can better customize and create more programming and content and engagement opportunities for the community around those key areas? And one of the key challenges we had, if you were trying to answer this question, and I gave you a good number at the beginning, I said 31,000, and that's actually a very accurate number, which I know, because we had the luxury of getting to collaborate with a team from the information lab within the data school and in their New York office and work on doing some reconciliation where we've had two different membership intake forms. So we had a Google form and then we had a new form in our member space environment. And we'd never really gotten a good system in place for doing really consistent deduplication across those two forms and entities. They had some different fields. The original form wasn't very clean data. And so we had the luxury of having that team work a lot on the data cleanup and data engineering bits to get a unified data set that then allowed us to start to drill in and ask more questions of our data. Like, I mean, we know the US is a big part of our membership, but where else do we have a good number of members where we have like a kind of good sized cohort who maybe we should help connect with each other more or spin up a local chapter? And so instead of trying to make assumptions and just talking at a high level and in aggregate about those numbers, we've been actively looking at and drilling into that data set, looking at our membership and saying both like kind of where are people that we can connect them more as local communities, but also what have people said that they wanted to learn or know and spend time on as part of DVS? And a big area for that is around professional development and learning. And so how do we then kind of take that nugget and say, well, if that's a big area of focus, what do we do with it? We have a number of people who are in our organization who work on specifically digital analytics. I never would have known that without kind of digging in and ranking and looking at areas of expertise on this dashboard. How are we serving those folks? How did they find us? Like, wouldn't it be great to know more about how they found us? Was there some place where someone linked a DVS blog on a Digital Analytics Association email newsletter? I don't know. But we can dig into data and look at kind of where people were referred from. How did they find out about us in terms of diving into that data more? And so that's a key piece of that story finding piece that we're looking at now, with the goal of being able to both let it inform some of our kind of practical and tactical goals for 2024 and beyond, but also when it comes to February, be able to reflect it to the broader community and say, you know, let's give you a snapshot of the community that you're a part of, and let's help you kind of see your place, not just as one number within 30 plus thousand people, but kind of how you have similarities to other folks within this community and getting down to those stories, which will also include anecdotes and comments from individual members. So that's a really big arc from kind of the messy data piece of doing some data reunification all the way over to thinking about that story finding and storytelling.
Awesome. Looking forward to seeing the visualizations that come from.
Well, I'm looking forward to hopefully putting a small data set out and seeing what our members come up with for visualizations of some of that membership data. That's always fun.
Oh, true. Yeah. Open sourcing it for sure. Final question. This is something I ask all of my guests, is people that are thinking about changing careers, students who are looking to get into the field, any kind of advice you'd have for folks who are looking to get into this world of data visualization, data storytelling, data journalism?
One thing I would recommend anyone looking to make a career leap think about is the fact that no matter what field you're working in now, I promise you have relevant and translatable skills into the world of data analytics and visualization. And I say that and believe it wholeheartedly, that the technical skills that you need to kind of continue to build different kinds of charts and graphs, you can master, and you can build a foundation of fundamentals in data visualization that are very practical and useful. But all of the other things you've done, even if, say, you're a writer or you've been a manager who maybe consumes charts and graphs every so often, or you're an elementary school teacher, you have skills around communications and how you communicate. How do you kind of write those headlines or narratives? How do you collaborate with end users and stakeholders to understand their needs? You have those kind of communication skills. You can think about transferable project management skills when you can show how you can break a big thing, a big project down into smaller pieces. And you can think about all of those other elements and angles of what data work looks like. I do think if you're looking to get into data visualization specifically and focusing on really building a career where a good amount of your time is spent doing data visualization design, whether it's charts and graphs and data storytelling and data journalism, or it's working in business intelligence and reporting, I think it's really important to kind of master some of those fundamentals and understand why different design decisions are made in data visualizations. So that as you look at a chart, even in a tool like Excel, you can sit there and make a purposeful design decision on, do I want to keep the grid lines here? Yes or no, and why? What colors am I going to choose? Will it be a sequential, a diverging, a categorical, a highlight palette? Where will I go ahead and choose to add or reduce the number of ticks or kind of individual units along my axes? Thinking about all of those individual design decisions and understanding why those choices are made, why do we declutter and focus our charts? And it's for memorability and recall. Why do we do those things? Not just that you should do them to check a box. You'll find lots of kind of quick boot camps and data visualization checklists that say, just do all these things and your chart will be great. But if you don't know who you're communicating to and who your audience is, and you can't articulate and have a conversation about why you're making the design decisions you are, you're losing out on such an opportunity to just level up what your craft is. So mastering some of those fundamentals, I think, is really important. And getting really good at one of the tools in the domain that you want to work in. If you're doing BI and business intelligence and dashboards, that might mean getting pretty good at either Tableau or Power BI or Qlik or whatever your industry kind of standard is. Because once you know one of those tools really well, let me tell you that Google is your best friend. You learn how to build complex LOD calculations in Tableau. You can go Google and look for who's solved how to do similar things in Power BI. But you have to learn the language of at least one of those tools to best leverage the forums and the communities that have been built up around these data visualization tools and to get good answers. So don't be intimidated. Know that you have transferable skills no matter where you're coming into this field from, number one. And number two, making sure that you invest in those fundamentals and learning a tool really, really well, and then using that to springboard your learning on other spaces. Like languages, right? Once you learn a second language, what's a third? What's a fourth? I say this as someone whose French is abhorrent, despite being one class shy of a university degree in French. But I think that as you think about the ways in which you kind of learn and master different parts of this craft, not trying to spread yourself too thin is a big part of that.
Fabienne, very good. That was great advice. And I guess I'll kind of give this call to action on behalf of you is also look at joining the Data Visualization Society. As you just heard, they are focusing on professional development, or I've seen that needs. So
yeah,
you'll probably
love to have you.
Find some opportunities there. Well, Amanda,
yeah,
I think
DVS is a great and welcoming space for any new practitioners interested in leveling up data visualization skills. We love having folks join and be part of our early career programming and being part of DVS. I also think that broadly, the world of data practitioners on the whole is really welcoming. And so don't be afraid to connect with people who you admire their work or who you might not know. People love talking about what they do in this field. So don't be afraid to reach out and say hi, whether it's on LinkedIn or Blue Sky or wherever else people are floating around these days on social media.
Sounds good. Don't be afraid. Amanda, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. And I'll definitely share all the links and things you mentioned in the show notes. And yeah, just thank you again for sharing your experience.
Of course. Thank you so much for your time and great to have a chance to have this conversation. And I hope for everyone listening, you've taken at least one interesting thing away that you're going to build even slightly better charts and graphs and tell clearer data stories coming out of listening to this podcast.